The House Committee on Revenue for June 13, 2007 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3452. Chris? Or Paul, sorry.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3452 amends the statute governing public bodies and self-insurance. And it, if you look at the original bill, 3452, it describes the process for going about a self-insurance program. And then on on the page 2, it refers to a change when there are three or more public bodies and lists the criteria in terms of reserves. And then the original bill states the requirements in this paragraph do not apply if the program purchases an aggregate stop-loss insurance and maintains adequate reserves. So it's creating an exception in the case of use of stop-loss insurance. Now there's a dash one that I just saw. Maybe our sponsors can explain that.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record today, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. With me today is Frank Stratton, the Insurance Services Program Manager, to discuss the Dash 1 amendments. In 1985, the Special Districts Association established a self-insured trust to assist local governments who could not affordably obtain liability and property insurance coverage. And today our program provides coverage for nearly 900 special service districts and 35 different types of service districts. The purpose of a self-insured public entity property and liability program is to control the costs and provide stability of insurance coverage that are available to public bodies. We accomplish this by sharing risks jointly and similarly, commonly referred to as pooling, and that's what this legislation attempts to address. Public pooling is a very common phenomenon. It arose in the mid-1980s when the private insurance market could not provide public entities with an insurance market, or if they could, the prices were very unaffordable. Nationwide, there are over 1,000 public entity pools. Public entity pools do not sell insurance, we're not regulated by the insurance code. Instead, we aggregate group risks, maintain self-insured retention, and purchase reinsurance for catastrophic losses for the members of the pool. All of the funds retained by a self-insured program are the assets of the public bodies, and that's as a result of ORS 190, which is the Intergovernmental Agreement Statute. They all execute agreements to form an ORS 190 public body. We believe that these assets should be managed with the highest degree of professionalism and financial transparency and for the direct benefit of those public bodies. Last legislative session, we sponsored Senate Bill 837 with the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties to subject ourselves to some minimum requirements that must be met in order to be self-insured public bodies. As a result of that legislation, we have found a couple of loopholes that we would like to close this legislative session, and I will let Mr. Stratton address those.
The two loopholes that we are looking to close is one of the key requirements of the legislation from last session was $1 million requirement for contributions into the self-insured program, meaning that if you're going to do this, if you're going to get public entities together, you need a critical mass to really make it work. And to make that critical mass work, you need $1 million to go into the self-insured fund. We need to make sure that $1 million is required is actually self-insured. And right now there's a loophole where you could essentially go out and buy $1 million insurance policy and say that meets the $1 million requirement for the self-insured fund. And of course that's not at all the intent of the legislation. So we're trying to clarify that by saying that the required $1 million in annual contributions is in addition to any amounts paid by the participating public bodies for the purpose of acquiring excess insurance for the self-insured program. So that clarifies that. The other change that we're looking for is another key requirement is that if you're going to put together this type of program, you need at least 25% of your annual contributions into a surplus account, essentially a savings account, to cover unanticipated and catastrophic losses. We've discovered another loophole there where entities tried to meet that requirement by taking out a loan, essentially a note, surplus note. And that in our mind absolutely does not meet the intent of the statute. You need to have cash in the bank, in a reserve account. This is a public entity, 190 program. That'd be tantamount to a city going out and taking out a loan to meet its reserve requirements. So that, in summary, is what we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Frank Hacina, for this testimony. Is there any indication that companies or that folks have come forward and attempted to show a loan into their operation and taking that loan? I've got $1 million cash in this pocket, but I've got $1 million debt in the other pocket, which would wash, but there is and calling that the reserve or the fund available for the unallocated surplus.
Yes, there have been. And evidently, there's certain types of insurance company accounting transactions that allow for this type of mechanism. But again, this is public entities, and we think that absolutely it shouldn't be allowed.
Creating accounting, Mr. Chair.
That was my impression, too.
Anything further than that?
Other questions or comments for this panel? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill today? I don't see anybody, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3452. You ready to work this bill? Let's open a work session on House Bill 3452.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move the -1 amendment dated 6607 to House Bill 3452.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 3452. Discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair,
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 3452 as amended today in committee to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3452 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Walters.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye. Excused.
Aye.
Aye. The motion having received the required majority, House Bill 3452 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I notice, Mr. Witt, you're among the sponsors. Would you like to carry this bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Witt will carry. Having completed our business on that work session, we'll close the work session. And open the work session on House Bill 3260. Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3260 has a -1 amendments, which is the bill. And it may look familiar to you because it looks very much like the -2 to 2001. And if you recall, there was an issue around the relating to clause in 2001. So this particular bill was relating to tax expenditures, so this fits in. Just to recall what it does, it creates this tax accountability commission consisting of 14 members, spells out the membership, requires this commission to review a list of expenditures. The amendment does include a list of 50 of the most expensive income tax expenditures that meet the criteria. The original bill had, or the last amendment you looked at, had personal income and corporate income. But, of course, many of the credits you look at or tax expenditures you look at affect both personal and corporate. So that was combined into just a kind of a benchmark for the commission to look at. The substantive change on this is that previous version said the commission will review and audit the list of tax expenditures, and audit was deleted at the request of Secretary of State's office because of the constitutional implications of that and the role of the auditor's office from the Secretary of State. So that has been taken care of and removed. It does establish a staffing for the commission, which would be consist of the Legislative Revenue Office and then support the Department of Revenue, Secretary of State, and Department of Administrative Services. We do anticipate a modest fiscal on this, and which we estimate, if you have a meeting of 14 members, based on our experience with interim committees, it tends to run about $2,000 per meeting in terms of expenses, and we would run about a $3,000 fixed cost, which would run about $20,000 for 10 meetings. So that gives you some sense of what that would be. Typically, what happens in terms of our budget Legislative Revenue Office, if we've taken on a task like this, we'll get some additional dollars through the Assembly to do that.
Thank you. What's your pleasure? Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you. I notice on page 3, Paul, it says, line 14, may hire and use independent expert as it deems necessary. That could get terribly expensive, could it not? So I guess, I mean, your fiscal sounds fine until you start talking about hiring experts.
Potentially that could. We would not anticipate that, but you're right. If we did that, then the hourly rates would go up from there. Some of it also depends on what kind of level of involvement you'd have. You could have review of the documents and that kind of thing, which we've done in the past. So, but yes, that potentially could add some costs.
Well, of course, the Ways and Means process could put a limitation on what could be spent in that category.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
To that common question, typically what's happened is that each time we've broached any of the tax expenditures, we've had a plethora of economists come forward representing all sides of the spectrum, and so it's been very interesting how many different opinions you can get amongst these unhired experts that do show up.
Experts someone else pays.
Someone else is paying. So I got a sneaking suspicion. I've got a suspicion that that this is going to bring those same folks forward, and they're going to pay their same experts and specialists to come in and advocate for or against certain positions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do not want to make an issue of it. I just wanted it noted that, you know, I would like to keep this fiscal under control, and so I would like to just put on the record that this is not an open checkbook to hire.
Oh, you're no fun.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Paul. I don't see it, but is there anything in here that would prescribe or direct the two people that basically select the entire commission, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate? Is there anything in there that when they're selecting either members of the general public, which would be more problematic, but members of the legislature, that requires them to find any partisan balance? And I ask the question because this commission could do very good work, for sure, but could always be accused of having a partisan bent based on who does or who does not control both bodies of the legislature.
Representative Bruin, I don't see a express a breakdown of that, but certainly our experience has been that there is an effort, just from a credibility standpoint, to have a good cross-section from the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. The part of a commission like this is to present us something that we can actually use, and I think it wouldn't have much credibility if it didn't do that.
I only ask the question, Mr. Chair, because obviously the reason this is here in the first place, a lot of these tax credits have political baggage. They certainly have allies and opponents, and tax credits, in my limited experience, have tended to perhaps, unfortunately, fall along partisan lines too often.
Mr. Chair, so as to continue the discussion, I'm going to move the -1 amendments be appended to House Bill 3260, and those amendments are dated 6-12-07, which I understand guts the bill and replaces it with the -1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that we replace the bill with the -1 amendments. Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Without any objection, the amendment is adopted. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, we've had excellent discussions on this, and I've already indicated that if we were going to audit this, I'd love to apply, but as long as we're not going to audit it, I'll just be happy to stick my name in the review column at that point. So I would like to make a motion then that we move House Bill 3260 to the floor of the House of Representatives as it's been amended today in committee.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3260 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is that right, Representative Butler?
With yes, do-pass.
With a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion? I don't see any. Call the roll, please.
Representative Gruen.
Aye.
Representative
Grillen.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative
Belkin.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Aye. And I'll carry the bill. The motion having received the required majority is declared adopted, and Barnhart will carry. And with that, we can close the work session on House Bill 3260. Are you making a motion on SB 819? Oh, okay. It's a conflict amendment.
Mr. Chair, did we open
the work session? Let's open the work session, thank you, on Senate Bill 819.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote which this committee passed, Senate Bill 819.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 819. The motion is not debatable. Those are the opinions that the rules should be suspended for this purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 819 will say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Don't hear any no's. The motion carries, and the rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 819 was sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 819 was sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Let me simply note that the purpose of this reconsideration is to get an amendment for the purpose of resolving a conflict. And that is in your bill folder as the dash fives. Is that right? The dash fives. Mm-hmm. Any further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is carried.
Let's go forward with the work session.
Yes.
Would you like to move the A5 first?
Sure. Why not?
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion at this time that the A5 amendment be appended to Senate Bill 819-6. Of 613-07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the A5 amendment. Paul, would you describe what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. This is a conflict amendment. It's an interesting conflict, though. As you recall, House Bill 3048, in which you changed the corporate kicker calculation to the prior year, in that bill, it used the old language that you can see on page 3, line 16, saying that the credit shall be computed after the allowance. And, of course, the whole point of Senate Bill 819 was to change that calculation from after to before the allowance. And so this, therefore, the conflict here in 819 would override House Bill 3048, so that would then become the calculation when both bills become law.
Mr. Chair, question.
Yes, please. Representative Butler.
So basically what we have, Paul, is that this would affect both corporate and individual taxpayers, providing them the same opportunity that we've previously afforded in the House bill or in the bill previously passed to have both full benefit of their tax credits as well as the opportunity to receive a refund under the kicker law.
Representative Butler, House Bill 3048 did not make the policy change of going to the before credit calculation. I mean, that was if only House Bill 3048 passes and this doesn't pass, then that would go into effect, continue the same credit calculation or after credit calculation we do now, and then would use the prior year. But if 819 then becomes law, it will override that before credit or after credit calculation, make it a before credit. And this is the bill that institutes that policy change, not 3048. So,
and for clarification, Mr. Chair, this does do that for both individual as well as business tax returns.
That's correct, Representative Butler, and it will apply to the refunds scheduled throughout this fall.
Thank you,
and corporate in future years.
Thank you, Representative. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I just wanted to ask, so does this affect the amount that we're actually putting into the rainy day fund by doing this?
Representative Rosenbaum, no. This only affects the distribution of the refund, in this case, the corporate kicker credit has been, for this biennium, has been suspended, well, not suspended, but basically eliminated by your decision to raise the estimate, which was in House Bill 2707. So that estimate has been raised, so you have no corporate kicker. But corporate kickers in the future years under this bill would also be calculated on a before credit basis, so it would change that distribution. But neither personal nor corporate kicker totals are affected by this bill, only the distribution of them.
Is that responsive to your question?
Well, I think if the answer is it has no effect on the amount that we're putting into the rainy day fund, then
yes, that does
answer.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, then, where this is, my recollection was that in the previously passed legislation, the corporations would, in effect, almost receive a voucher for future, because of the changes that we've made, would receive vouchers that were good for future years for the actual payment of taxes, so that could be used. This still vouchsafes that arrangement which we had previously implemented. What does it do for the individuals in that regard, Paul? How's the mechanic of it work?
Representative Butler, it does raise the possibility that you addressed in House Bill 3048, that you can have a kicker credit, or an individual can have a refund that exceeds their liability in that year. What this does is allow individuals to receive a refund based on that pre-credit amount that may exceed their total liability. In which case, under federal tax law, that would become income for taxable purposes.
Okay.
Okay. Further discussion of the Dash 5 amendments. Representative Berger.
I just want to state for the record that we now have a new definition of what is a really interesting conflict amendment, courtesy of our economist and our CPA.
It's a good thing, isn't it, that
yes.
Our economists are well-educated and can explain all of these things to us. Anything else on the Dash 5s?
Mr. Chair.
Is there objection to the Dash 5s? I don't hear an objection, so the Dash 5s are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 819, as amended today with the A5s, to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 819, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Brown.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared adopted. House Bill or Senate Bill 819, as amended, will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who was carrying that bill? Who was assigned to carry that bill before?
Was Representative Butler?
Thank you. Do you want to carry this one?
Yeah.
A little more complicated.
Well, that's fine.
All right. Representative Butler will carry. Okay.
All we've got is 2501.
And we haven't got the amendment yet back, have we? We haven't received it yet. We have an amendment? No. Okay. We'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 151. seem to have the list, so.
I don't find the original bill in this mess.
How many different today, though?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It's like
yesterday. Okay. Oh boy. All right. Looks like everybody has signed up again. Okay. Continue a public hearing, and you'll get more people signed up. All right. Last time I asked if Bob Shiprack wanted to be heard. Is he here today? Yeah.
He's down the hall. Still having a smoke.
There he is. Oh, he is? Oh, yeah. You want to be heard on this bill? Not a requirement. I have lots of people.
1 minute.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologize, I had to leave yesterday. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I want to just make two very brief comments because you got something in writing from me yesterday and why I am concerned about enterprise zones and the fact that we increasingly have a problem with large property tax abatements, tax giveaways to attract business, and I understand all of that. But the problem with our existing statutes is that there's no requirement whatsoever in the statutes, and despite my pleadings to the state and the local governments, that when they give these breaks away to these people, they never ask, by the way, who's going to construct these facilities? Are you going to try and use local contractors? The example I gave yesterday, if you read it, it happens to be in a project in Albany, and I've discussed it with Representative Olson. It's happened in Representative Witt's district. It happened in the chair's district, where as soon as the company gets the tax breaks, the next thing we know is there's an out-of-state contractor, oftentimes bringing in their own workforce, and doing the job. I don't think that the use of taxpayer dollars to attract business to a location should suffer at the local workforce, and that's my issue, and I won't belabor it. I've been in front of legislators now for three sessions over this issue. Doesn't seem to be resolved. We're going to ask for the amendments being drafted to have a real interim examination of enterprise zones, come back to the legislature, and hopefully have some language that compels local governments and the state to ask these questions when they give out this money, so that maybe Oregonians, companies and workers can share in the benefits of what they're contributing. That's the extent of my comments.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Do you want to say anything about the Oregon forest products industry at the same time using Oregon products? They're just Oregon labor.
Absolutely. You can get me started on that.
We have some other people to talk about that. I just wanted to throw that in. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Cluding. Bill? And do you have someone else who wants to testify with you?
Thank you, Chair Barinhart. For the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council Committee. Appreciate the chance to talk to you on this very critical issue for the members of my workforce in this state and the Northwest and all the United States. Before this came out in 151, I knew about this much about enterprise zones, but through all the meetings we've been having and sitting through this, I could almost be a consultant now on enterprise zones. But to get to my point, the Carpenters is all for energy sufficient building. Nationwide, the Carpenters have been involved in this for years. Our problem is Leeds. Now, there is other organizations out there that do this same type of work, So the Gartners did a study. They had the University of Minnesota do a long study on comparing these different organizations on their capabilities, their work, and their costs. And ironically, only one of these firms does not recognize the vast majority of our organ-grown products, and that's Leeds. We have sat with these folks nationwide, tried to negotiate a package. Now, to them, energy-sufficient material, building material, is bringing bamboo from China into this state and putting it in our buildings. And that's a fact. And here we have workers in this state. We have the best forest practices in the world. And this company will not sit down and negotiate a fair program that would benefit our workers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. Bill and I have been working on this green building issue all session. We started our work on Senate Bill 576, which I don't think is going to make it over to the House side, but it was a bill that designated Leeds as a system that state buildings had to adhere to, and we object to that because it disadvantages Oregon wood products. We were able to meet with the proponents of the bill and hammer out a compromise to that. But while we were doing that, we missed Senate Bill 151 as it made its way across the Senate with Leeds attached to it in the B engrossed version. So now that it's here, we object to that as well. And Bill and I have been working over the last couple of weeks to try to find a way to not damage the bill's intent, which was to extend the sunset of the enterprise zones, but make the language on Leeds something that we could live with. And we've done that to a certain extent. We appreciate the governor's office and Oregon Environmental Council. I think Lindsay's going to talk as well. We really appreciate their efforts to try to find a way to get through that maze. But as it turns out, I don't know that there is one that we could find in the short amount of time that we had. So there was an agreement to get rid of the amendments that created the B engrossed version and go back to the A engrossed version, which is slightly different than the original bill. The two main differences there are the extension of the enterprise zones goes to 2013 and not 2021, and then the addition of the study that is included in the A engrossed and B engrossed versions is different than the original bill. So we're opposed to the bill as is B engrossed form, but we understand that there are amendments that are going to create a bill that we can live with, which is the 2013 extension and the study, and just wanted to say thanks for everybody's work. I know that you all have been working hard on this, the governor's office, Bill and I, Lindsay, and a variety of different folks, and just wanted to say thanks for all the hard work. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Tom Hughes, is it Wes Hare or Har? Ron Papsdorf?
Guess we lost Ron.
Guess so.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes. I'm the mayor of the city of Hillsboro, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 151. I believe you're going to receive some proposed amendments that would narrow the scope of the bill and, among other things, would narrow it so that it no longer, the expansion would not apply to the city of Hillsboro. We were just recognized last year for our enterprise zone. We've really only had it in operation for about a year now, but in that year's time we have three applications that we've already approved and three applications that are pending that will probably amount to about $200 million or $300 million worth of construction in our community. We have managed to retain the services of one high-tech company that was considering moving to Texas, and have attracted. I think the best use, probably or most obvious use so far, has been the second and hopefully subsequent phases of Genentech have qualified for Enterprise Zone. The parts that didn't qualify for SIP have now qualified for Enterprise Zone. The other thing about the Hillsborough, and I think that it's important to understand a lot of. I've heard it said a number of times, why does Hillsborough need incentives? People are lining up to come into your city already, and I think that misunderstands the fight that we are in to get every retention and every successful recruitment that we've had. Our competition is not with rural Oregon. Our competition is with Phoenix and Austin and the Boston area. And on the most recent one that we lost, actually, we were the last American site left on the list, and the facility is going to wind up going to Taiwan. So we're in a global competition. We need every incentive that we can do. The second thing is that this particular incentive that I like, the thing I like about this incentive is that it really is targeted on some effort to bring into the community the opportunities to try to realize the old saw about working your way out of poverty. We have some extreme, persistent, and embarrassing poverty in portions of Hillsborough that have been included in the residential portion of the Enterprise Zone. In examining the details about that residential area, one of the things that leaps out at you is that the residents of that zone are grossly undertrained for the kinds of jobs that are coming into the community. And so we've used our Enterprise Zone. We have a clause in our Enterprise Zone that in order to qualify for the fourth and fifth year of the abatement, the company has to pay a fee in lieu of to the city of 25% of their abatement, which we then put in a training program to focus on training projects for the people who are residents of the residential portion of the zone. We discovered, for example, that 45% of them, only 45% of the adults over the age of 18 have attained a GED or better. And so part of our training program will be focused on GED promotion. Part of it will be on general employment skills, and part of it will go back to those companies and say, what kind of skills do you need? So I think we have a comprehensive training program, and it really is the unique part about the Enterprise Zone that it allows communities to tie economic development to solutions for poverty that exists within our communities. So I'll let the other two gentlemen.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. Gentlemen, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wes Hare. I'm the city manager in Albany and have been a city manager in the state of Oregon now for about 20 years, working in Lowell, Oak Ridge, LeGrand, and now Albany. And the Enterprise Zone is a tool. It's a tool that helps us create jobs around the state. And I would submit that it's been a pretty effective tool in many, many different cases. We sometimes forget about what prompted the creation of enterprise zones, but I remember really well. It was back in the 1980s when unemployment was at double digits in the state, when I had to stand in line with 300 or 400 other people down in Eugene to get a job as a clerk at a 7-Eleven store. And wasn't hired, by the way, because I had a college degree. You know, we've come a long way since then, but I think I live with the realization that those days might return. And we're in a very competitive world where it is difficult, as Mayor Hughes has pointed out, to compete with not only other communities around the United States, but also other nations. Specifically, as I said, I've been doing this for 20 years, and the most recent example, you heard a little testimony about it earlier, about the PepsiCo plant. In the 20 years that I've been doing this, I've never had a firm come to a community that I represented that promised this level of job creation, this level of pay, or this level of investment. And in doing a little research in the city of Albany, there's never been a company of this size offering this range of pay and benefits to come to the city of Albany before. It's a first. It just hasn't happened. Now, there have been other industries surrounding the area, in Millersburg and so forth. But in Albany itself, there's never been a firm the size of Pepsi. And I can testify that they would not be there were it not for the Enterprise Zone benefits that we were able to offer them. And in fact, You may be aware that there's been some there's been an announcement that Pepsi is actually delaying their investment. And when they came to us to announce the delay, they actually were trying to negotiate a potential exit. Fortunately, we had a contract with them that that will prevent that. They will be locating in Albany. The only question now is when. But again, if we were giving them so much, it wasn't enough to hold them. There were other factors that are enter into their decision-making processes. So my argument would be simply that I don't think it's good policy to do away with a tool or to cripple a tool that has been so helpful to us in creating jobs around the state. And I still, after having done this for a very, very long time, I think that's a legitimate policy objective for folks here in the state of Oregon, is to create as many jobs as we possibly can. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Papsdorf, representing the city of Gresham. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 151 today. We have a relatively new enterprise zone in the city of Gresham. Was established in 2006. We've already secured one business to locate within our enterprise zone, and we're in negotiations with one very large existing business to actually expand their operations within the boundaries of our enterprise zone, add significant manufacturing capacity and employment to this major employer, and expand their facilities. I think one of the important issues to consider in the Enterprise Zone program is that even urban areas have significant pockets of poverty and crime, and the city of Gresham is not unlike other cities around the state. We have a part of our community that's facing significant difficulties and has been in a downward spiral for many years. We're trying to use every tool that's available to us to try to turn around that part of our community, increase employment opportunities for our citizens, and make sure that there's new investment happening in a community, in a part of our community that's been experiencing significant amounts of disinvestment over the years. We have very few tools available to us, though. This is an important piece of the efforts that are available to us to draw in traded sector industries into our community that have significant ripple effects for the rest of the community. When we draw in a traded sector company, it also attracts other supporting businesses and adds to the overall economic vitality of the area. This type of economic development tool that draws jobs into urban areas is just as important in urban areas as it is in rural areas. In fact, during the last recession, the Portland metropolitan area was hit harder than the rest of the state in terms of unemployment rates. It is important to continue this effective economic development tool available to local jurisdictions. We support the bill. We do oppose the Dash B8 amendments that would take cities that have a population larger than 50,000 out of the Enterprise Zone program.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Berger.
I don't have a question, but I'd like to make a comment. Over the weekend, my husband was watching some sports thing or another, and I was struck by an ad by the state of Michigan offering incentives to, they had a high-profile actor come on and say, come to Michigan, bring your high-tech company, we're going to give away lots of deals, bring your jobs. It just speaks to the competition that these mayors are trying to address. There are plenty out there who want these jobs.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wes, we received yesterday a handout from Bob Shipwreck, and he testified earlier, and one of the concerns that he brought to us was Gatorade operations that's looking at Albany, and you're the city manager there, aren't you?
Yeah.
You may recall when you were in Eastern Oregon that we had this same rush to the bottom with regard to a Coca-Cola bottling plant between Nyssa, Ontario, and Fruitland, Idaho. And it was who could give away the most. All of the property taxes for 15 years. And finally, it was Fruitland that gave away the most. Gave them free utilities, including all of the water that they could use, which for a Coca-Cola bottling operation is a lot of water. The concern we've got is that when these folks then decide that, you know, the 15 years of free taxes are up, and and 15 years of free utilities are up, then they're out fishing looking for another place to go. And I don't know that you've seen the handout which Bob Shipwreck provided us yesterday, but the concern was that somebody picks up the freight in that process. Do you feel like, and I know you've had a lot of experiences bringing good businesses into larger Eastern Oregon communities, do you feel like that the trade-off is justified when you get one of these big operators to land in your community?
Well, I think you have to analyze each deal. I mean, you have to be very pragmatic about what the costs and benefits are of whatever is on the table. A big piece of why PepsiCo is very attractive to Albany is that we have completed or are in the process of completing about $100 million of infrastructure projects to do water and wastewater. Our rates are very, very high. PepsiCo helped stabilize those rates, and they're paying full freight. We didn't give them utility rates. And as far as the property tax benefit that they're receiving, we're not handing them a check. It's just revenue that we're not receiving. Actually, we're getting some property tax revenue just off the increased value of the land that they've purchased. It's been in farm deferral, and so it now moves up to about $12 million, which does represent some property tax income to us. Bear in mind that that property was zoned for industrial use over 20 years ago. It's been in farm deferral ever since, so it sure hasn't been generating a lot of property tax over that last 20-year period. Now, PepsiCo's history in terms of these plants, the ones like they're planning to build there, we've done some research, is good. They have plants in Indianapolis, Indiana. They have a plant in Arizona that's been open since the early 1990s. So they haven't showed a propensity to move around a lot. They're a good employer. We checked on their record. They're offering, as I said, they're the first company to come into Albany offering 150% of the median county wage, and so it's a deal that makes sense. I don't consider this a race to the bottom. I consider it a reasonable calculation. It went through a very public process where our city council had the opportunity to review it. The Linn County Board of Commissioners reviewed it and voted unanimously to support it. And so, obviously, I think it was a reasonable decision that is in the best long-term interests of our community.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what all of the giveaways are. I don't know what the final settlement was with the. I know what NISA and Ontario were offering, and there was some conclusion that the folks in Idaho had to have given a lot more. The problem I've got is I just want to know that these are done on a very analytical basis as opposed to showing up at a city manager's meeting with 200 other state city managers in the state and saying, na-na-na-na-na-na.
Well, I can assure you that's not the case. I guess it depends on how much faith you put in local government. Of course, you were a county commissioner, so I presume you have some faith in your colleagues around the state that they're going to analyze these things and try and determine that the best interest of, in this case, Linn County. This is not a case, there's not a nickel of City of Albany taxpayer money going to subsidize PepsiCo in a direct sense. I mean, we're not writing a check to them. We are foregoing revenue that we otherwise would not have received. To me, there is a distinction there. Now, maybe to others, there's not. But again, you look back on the history of the site, and you can make a pretty good case for that.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler, if I can interject too. To be really honest with you, if in those projects where it's a race to the bottom, Hillsborough doesn't win those races because we really don't have a lot of tools to throw at a recruitment. Our understanding is that one of our large successful recruitments recently that the competition down in Texas actually had $50 million more in incentives than we were able to offer, and they still chose to come here. And I've had other people say that they'd pay $50 million not to have to go to Texas too. But but I think that's part of the advantages that we have up here. The other thing that is the good advantage of the Enterprise Zone is it really does allow the local governments to craft the kind of program that they want to go after. In ours, for example, owing to the nature of our relationship with our Chamber of Commerce, we have a pretty strict requirement for using local contractors, for example, if you're going to successfully apply for the Enterprise Zone, which I didn't see Mr. Shipwreck's handout, but we had a conversation earlier about it, and I think that if you hold local officials accountable at the local level to make sure that those kinds of things get in the enterprise zone, the tool is adaptable to allow you to do that.
And just to follow up, and if I could, to Mayor Hughes. Mayor Hughes, do you also, like Ron, also oppose the B8 amendments? Size of city.
Representative Barnard, Representative Butler. For some obvious reasons, Ron and I represent two of the seven cities that would not get the advantage of the extension of the sunset. We're kind of intrigued with that because none of the seven cities on the list have special districts that would be impacted by enterprise zones. So we're a little confused about how that became an issue. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel?
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony very much. Steve Bryant, Doug Griggs, Gil Riddell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Bryant, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Passing out a handout, perhaps you've seen it before, but just to continue the theme from cities, what you have here is the list of the 98 cities across the state that are currently enterprise zone sponsors. You have the list as well as the map showing the location of those cities. It also shows that three ports are sponsors. And I believe 30 out of 36 counties. I think I can be fairly brief, and I would start with sort of the rhetorical question, which is why is it that these cities are so supportive of enterprise zones when we are primarily reliant on property tax income as our primary source of general fund income, the same source of revenue that special districts rely on, and special districts, of course, have expressed concerns. And I would submit that cities are nothing more than a conglomeration of special districts. I mean, we offer the same types of services, fire services, sewer services, water services, parks and recreation services, library services, and we do that through property taxes. But we have to look at the wholeness of our communities and what it is that makes communities healthy places to be. That is dependent on our ability to attract good businesses that pay decent jobs with benefits, and it's the enterprise zone program that provides for these cities the best tool that currently is available in our toolkit for doing exactly that. So we are willing to forego property tax revenues in the interest of the long-term benefit. It's the long-term creation of income in our community, both to our residents as well as to our units of government, that makes this a viable program. I know you had presented to you yesterday the results of the special district study, which attempted to demonstrate the very high cost per job created. When you look at a longer-term analysis of that study, the cost per job come way down. And in fact, I think we could demonstrate to you that there's a very large net benefit in terms of the dollars brought into the community per job created, depending on what time period you want to look at, 5, 10, 15 years. We must take a long-term view of this program and the benefit that it creates within our communities in order to do a proper assessment. And so we are supportive of the interim study that is called for in the bill that I think will do a very accurate job of looking at the cost benefits of the enterprise zone program and will deliver to you in the 2009 session, I think, a very good assessment of what this tool does for us. I have to tell you that with the plethora of amendments that are being introduced to this bill, there's a rising sense of concern amongst our zone sponsors because they are most concerned about extending the sunset date. That's our number one priority in this bill. But if we get out of the session without doing that, there will be a lot of concern because it will make it very difficult for us to continue to have these conversations with our existing businesses that are looking at this tool for their future expansion plans, as well as the new businesses that that we often entertain through the leads provided through OECD and our own economic development efforts. So our ask is that you look at a simplified version of this bill and get it moving. We are supportive of essentially the simple version of this bill that extends the enterprise zone sunset period to 2013, that commissions the study. We have no problem with the interim group work group being broadly representative of all of the interests that have spoken to the bill. I think that can happen through department directive. And that a study be delivered to you that really gets at some of the more complex issues that that have been raised. So with that, I'll ask our other panelists and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Rather than repeat the testimony of League of Cities, I'll simply say for the record that ALC supports the current bill. We would support the engrossed version, which is the more simplified version that Steve referred to.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. That group consists of Redmond, Bend, Madras, Maupin, Culver, Lapine, Sisters, and Metolius, nine cities in Central Oregon. We're the largest non-LOC organization representing small cities, and eight of our nine cities are below the 50,000 threshold. So on first blush, you might think, aha, this is an organization that might look at the -8s and the -9s and say, we'd support them. But nothing could be further from the truth, and let me give you a couple examples why. I think if you take a holistic approach to job creation, what you recognize is that Oregon is a pretty small state, and that economic development in one area of the state often relies on the other areas of the state. You can look at agriculture in eastern Oregon, which relies on the Port of Portland, being able to ship goods up and down. You could look at the new Solar World manufacturing facility coming into Hillsboro, which we think is going to provide tremendous opportunities for the solar manufacturing and R&D centers in Bend, Redmond, and Sisters that have cropped up in the last few years. So there's an integrated portion there. And then something that's near and dear to my heart is fuel cells. We have a company in Bend, an Oregon-based company, Idatech, that is one of the leading manufacturers of fuel cells in the world. There are also two fuel cell manufacturers in Washington County, one in Beaverton, one in Hillsboro, that there's going to be quite a bit of symbiotic relationships here. And so the idea that you can cut off urban parts of the state or cities with 50,000 people from an incentive program that will create jobs and help rural Oregon, or vice versa, in my mind, doesn't make an awful lot of sense. I do want to make a comment about the job creation and the job issue. This is something I've spent quite a bit of time on in the past few years, and in past lives I've spent quite a bit of effort working with trades. And I certainly acknowledge that there have been a number of examples over the last few years where companies have come into the state located in an enterprise zone and brought in the labor. And a great example was the Calpine project out in Umatilla County a number of years ago, where Calpine came in, refused to hire Oregon companies, refused to hire Oregon labor, instead brought in low-cost labor from Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama. At one point, they brought in pipe fitters from Argentina. And that's certainly not a situation which benefits either Oregon workers, Oregon companies, or Oregon cities. And so I would acknowledge that that's an issue that ought to be addressed in some way, shape, or form. We'd be perfectly willing to sit down with the committee, preferably during the interim, and come up with some language that would be mutually beneficial for all of us. So we acknowledge that that's a problem. But in summary, we would strongly support passing the bill either as written or with an amendment to simplify it and extend it through 2013. And by the same token, we'd strongly oppose the -8s and the -9s that have been presented before you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I would simply note that last study that you referred to might more properly be done through the Workforce and Economic Development Committee, although if they didn't want to, we probably would be involved in it. Anything else? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Ray Burstead, Chris Jarmer, Lindsay Capps.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Raymond Burstead. I am the executive director, not executive director, I'm the president of SEDCOR, the Strategic Economic Development Corporation. I'm also the zone manager for the Salem Enterprise Zone. And I could just ditto everything that the group in front of me just said. Enterprise zones are a critical part of our economic development opportunities. As an example, in Salem over the last year, I can point to a roughly $20,000 in capital investment and 200 jobs that would not be here, or a large portion of those would not be here had it not been for our ability to use enterprise zones.
$20,000?
$20 million.
$20 million. Thank you.
Excuse me.
I may have misheard you.
I may have misstated as well. But it's a critical component of our effort to attract new companies, but more critically to allow local companies that are already here to expand and create jobs. So I just would strongly suggest that the original bill, the 151, without the amendments, is what we would like to support and hope that the committee would approve.
Thank you very much. Last I looked, Salem had more than 50,000 people. Is that still true?
It's still true.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Environmental Council. Chris Tarbrough is going to join me up here this afternoon. I think he's already said his piece. I'm just here to speak specifically to the provisions in the bill that have to do with sustainable business practices. Back in January, the Oregon Leadership Summit got together, and many of Oregon's business leaders identified sustainability as a key strategy for economic development in the state. And we saw SB 151 as an opportunity to try to marry sustainability with, I think, a very important program in promoting new investment in communities across the state and create jobs. So we amended the bill in the Senate with unanimous vote endorsed by the Oregon Sustainability Board that would have provided an additional 4 or 5 year property taxes incentive for companies that can meet certain sustainability goals, such as the use of green building, use of renewable energy, the adoption of an environmental management system to reduce pollution, the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, and an annual sustainability report that would be made publicly available. We have since heard some concerns from industry stakeholders and from some folks in the labor community about this, and have tried to work through some of these issues. I think we addressed the LEED certification issue, which was not an exclusive thing, but nonetheless addressed that. But I think we still have some ways to go in looking at the mechanics of this and its applicability in zones around the state. And so, therefore, we do not object to removing those provisions. And I guess this would be the B-13 amendments. We do not object to those, but would hope that this body and this committee might consider taking this issue up again in the interim, since we believe this is a really important opportunity for Oregon, both in terms of job creation, but also our stake in the global economy. So with that, I appreciate the committee's time and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Yes.
One more quick item, Mr. Chairman. We are constantly competing with other states for projects. One of the major expansions we had here in Salem, we competed with the Home Office in another state. Had it not been for the enterprise zones, we would not have had that. It is critically important that we have this ability to do this, but I want you to understand that it's not a free ride. When the company makes their proposal for enterprise zone, they have a dollar amount of capital investment and they have jobs to be created. If either one of those two things aren't obtained in the time period set forth in the enterprise zone, they have to pay the full tax burden as though they had never applied. So it's not like it's a non-performance thing. They have to perform in order to get this advantage. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, quickly, Mr. Chair, I won't belabor it. Thank you, Lindsay, very much for your remarks, because as someone who's very aware, Salem has been using Enterprise Zone since the 80s. It was one of the first to very effectively use it. And I think we heard pretty good testimony that it needs to be something that is sort of localized. I think the mayor from Albany expressed they look at the land, they look at the zone, they look at what they're trying to get and how it fits in their community. And while I do applaud the sustainability efforts, adding that sort of piece, it sits like a lid on their ability to negotiate for you know, the best for their local community. So I really appreciate your willingness to back off and take another look at this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other comments, questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard at the public hearing today on Senate Bill 151? Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I would just like to make a couple observations. To Bob Shipwreck's point about the construction of a building, for the industrial worker, it's imperative that it's local workers. And in these enterprise zones, there should be guarantees that it is local workers that get these jobs. If we're so willing to guarantee business to come here, then we should guarantee the community that the jobs will be there for the community. To Representative Butler, we are in a race to the bottom. It seems the industrial worker is like the old redcoats during the Revolutionary War. We got to march in columns, and everybody shoots at us from different directions. It's a global economy that we're not winning. Years ago, about 15 years ago, I was involved in helping to make sure that Nucor did not come to Oregon. And there was someone on this committee that was with me, and that was Brad Witt. And the issue then was, it was the leader of the industry, the steel industry, and fatalities. It also led in worker comp violations, safety. And the other question I asked was, what is your average age of retirement? Because it was a young man's industry. They worked people to death. They worked them to the point where there was a fatality, and they wouldn't stop the production of the plant to get the body that was underneath many thousands of tons of steel. So I believe it's important that we look at the guarantees to the community and to the worker. Also, under Bill Cluding's point, we are so willing to take in dirty products, meaning not environmentally sound, and yet we have the products right here in our own state to utilize. So we need to look at what is good for the community, what is good for the worker of Oregon, as well as what's good for Oregon business. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. We appreciate very much your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 151. Paul, do we have the amendments back yet on House Bill 2592? House Bill 2592? You've received those back? All right. Thank you. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2592.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2592.
Thank you. Mr. Reed, Representative Reed moves that the rules be suspended to allow us to reconsider the vote by which we passed this House Bill 2592. The motion is not debatable. Those of the opinion that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering this vote, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
There is anyone opposed?
I am.
One opposed? Seven yes, one no. The motion carries. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2592 was sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves that the committee reconsider the vote by which it sent House Bill 2592 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, that one is debatable. Let me simply say that the purpose of this motion is to remove a section of the amended of the bill that we sent out that was related to local taxation, local income taxation of PERS benefits. It seems that there is additional problems with that section, and it needs to be reviewed further at another time. Any further debate? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'm anxious. First of all, I supported that portion of the local taxation policy that it would give us an opportunity to come back, examine, and relook at local taxation with regard to public employee retirement benefits being taxed at the local level should local governments decide to do it. This would basically bring us back full circle to where possibly, remember that When the giveaway was given away with regard to the taxation on PERS benefits, local governments kicked into the pot, but the state collected all of the revenue from it in the terms of increased income taxes. So I felt like that was a very good reason for us to have passed that portion, that amendment, into 2592. That said, the rest of 2592, I basically was in opposition to. And so what you're doing is that by coming back and reconsidering and then opening up 2592, the portion of 2592, which basically has a very, could have a very chilling effect on the real estate markets in the state of Oregon, plus the fact that I'm still concerned that what this bill does is it's based upon compliance, but it also raises revenue in the process. And there's no evidence ever presented to us in the earlier testimony that we were not collecting the revenue that these folks already owed, that this was just a method of speeding up a collection of revenue faster, quicker than what the folks would have paid it otherwise.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Now I'm reminded of the committee that we're on the motion to reconsider. Is there anything else on that motion? Is there anybody opposed to that motion? Representative Butler opposes. I'm assuming everyone else is in favor of it. Two are opposed.
I'll oppose the reconsideration. Is that what we're opposed?
That's what we're on at the moment.
Yeah.
Let's see. 1, 2, 3 opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5 in favor. The motion carries. Thank you. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move we rescind the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2592.
Representative Reed moves that we rescind the Dash 8. You know, it might be appropriate, before we get too far along here, that we describe what it is that we're trying to accomplish and ask Chris to describe the amendment that we're talking about putting in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The piece that is being pulled out?
Yes, both. Okay. Yeah.
Well, the piece that is being pulled out, the difference between the Dash 8 amendments, which were what the committee adopted last week, and the Dash 10, is language that would allow local governments to tax the benefits from the PERS system to the extent that those benefits would be attributable to employment after the effective date of this act. That language would not affect current retirees. It would just affect, for example, if the bill were to become effective, say, October 1, 2007, the benefits to accrue to individuals after that date would become taxable. So in the short run, there would be very minimal, if any, impact. It's very much a long-term approach to the taxation. And another important point is that currently there are no local governments that have an income tax. So it's very much a conditional piece of law.
Thank you. Representative Reed has moved that we rescind the adoption of the Dash 8 amendments. Is there further discussion? Is there any opposition to the rescinding the Dash 8 amendments? Representative Butler objects. Representative Berger objects. Anyone else? The rescission of the Dash 8 amendments is adopted. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 10 amendments to House Bill 2592 dated today.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves the Dash 10 amendments. Is there further discussion on the Dash 10s? If you will look on the Dash 10s, it appears to me as though they're word for word identical to the Dash 8, except for the material on the top of page 3 of the Dash 8s, which is omitted. Any further discussion on the Dash 10s? Is there any objection to the Dash 10s? Representative Butler objects. Representative Berger objects. Representative Olson objects.
Representative Bruin.
Representative Bruin objects. We're down to 5-4. With that, the Dash 10s are adopted. Thank you. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2592 as amended by the Dash 10s to the floor of the due process recommendation.
And a rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves Senate Bill or House Bill 2594 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request that the further referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there further discussion of that motion? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I have stood here and objected to the removal of this particular piece. I, unlike Representative Butler, did approve of the other section of this bill. I will therefore support this motion, retaining my right to change my mind when it gets to the floor.
Thank you.
But I think I've made it pretty clear that this section was not one that I wanted removed from this bill.
You have made that very clear. Thank you, Representative Berger. Other discussion? Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comments from Representative Butler and Representative Berger, and my hope is that we'll be able to come to a compromise at a later date on the portion that is removed by the Dash 10s, but I think there is sufficient benefit to the increased enforcement tools that the bill now provides, and I'd like to see it move forward.
Thank you, Representative Reed. Anything else? Please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Dillon. No.
Representative
Butler. No.
Representative
Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Olson.
No.
Representative
Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Westmore. Aye. Chair votes aye. The motion having received the required majority, the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request to rescind the referral, subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Representative Butler is serving notice that of a possible minority report on House Bill 2592 coming before.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Who did I assign to carry this bill? Representative Reed, would you carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Representative Reed will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2592. By way of announcement, it is my understanding that we have at least one additional amendment coming on Senate Bill 151, and I intend to work that bill tomorrow. And with that, I think we've completed our business today. Is there anything else? I'm not talking about the Dash 13s. I'm talking about a subsequent amendment. Thank you very much. With that, the committee stands in recess upon the call of the chair.